Anyway, nice to have all of you here today for our service. Have a good Sabbath. The sermon I'm giving today is a result of having read this book. It's called God Forsaken. It's by an author, Dinesh D'Souza. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's a nice picture of him in the back. And he is a person who addresses Christian issues, which most of us would agree with. And there are some things, of course, as with most people who are not prophets or not mentioned in the Bible, we might take exception to some of the things they might write and say. But he does touch on some points that I think are very, very important and might be helpful to us today as I discuss the subject from what I'm entitling the sermon, God's Eye View, or you might even say God's View. When I was reading this book, actually I had finished it, the tragedies that occurred last week, last Saturday night, over in Aurora? It was last Thursday, Friday, they occurred, and we were all horror-stricken by them. I still remain affected by it. I used to live in Aurora, Colorado. I'm pretty much aware of where that movie theater is, and you know, it's a beautiful place, a beautiful environment, and the tragedy of that evening. So it seemed to coincide with my having just finished this book to speak timely to the issue of what I would call horrendous evil. And horrendous evil is around us all the time. I would call that event that happened there certainly an evil. I even think horrendous tends to fit it because it's the innocent victims. It was not war, it was just people sitting in a theater. Others, when they think of horrendous evil, they think of things like the Holocaust, the purges by Stalin, where literally tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives. We also think of dismemberment of human bodies, terrible things like that, people being kidnapped, horrendous evil. So you would have an idea of what that might be. And I would like to talk about it from the Christian perspective. There's a term that's mentioned in this book, which I'm fond of. I think it describes many Christians. It's called a wounded theist. A wounded theist. And what that means is that's the person who has a belief in God, but something comes along that's almost inexplicably difficult to accept. A tragedy. The loss of a loved one. And the inevitable question is the same question that I saw a father cry out in his anguish over the loss of his child here in this movie Massacre, when he emotionally, after addressing the loss and the beautiful life of his child, he added, why? You know, that's the question. Why? I don't know that there's any perfect answer, but the one that I would like to at least give you to think about today and to discuss, because I think that we as God's people need to have a very firm understanding of God's role or his lack of participation in human suffering and to what degree that we individually are responsible. As I mentioned, it's all around us. I don't like to think about it, but it is. A couple of things that happened this past week or two that really got my attention. And the issue here is that in third world countries, and I thought this was an interesting statistic that was brought out time and time again in his book, is the issue of God's existence is not questioned by people who are suffering in third world countries. But it is questioned in America by Christianity, where we are richly, richly blessed. And some another, we have removed ourselves from the necessity to depend upon the provider because we have come to provide for ourselves. And in providing for ourselves, we've lost that connection which ties us into the creator of all the universe, which we're going to read about here in a little bit, who has at his heart, if I might put it in that language, the very best for us. But, you know, there are just things that happen that just, I mean, I don't get it. It scares me, I guess, because I don't want it to happen to me. And I recognize that in God's church, because I listen to our conversations, in our conversations, I find that we have what I would call an inappropriate acknowledgement of time and chance. That may not apply to you, but I know it applies to some because I've been in conversations with it, and I think it even applied to me years and years ago. I may not have the perfect balance yet, but I'm trying to achieve that, to try to understand and never, never, never implicate God in a negative way with my suffering or a disease or a loss or any kind of horrendous evil. And Betsy and I were talking about this morning, and she said, but you would ask the question if something happened to one of your children. You would ask, why? It's almost a natural knee-jerk reaction, isn't it? But we must, and I'd like to just talk about that and to try to add some balance. Here recently, one of the stories in the news that got my attention, because we have this idea that, you know, evil befalls evil people. Not really. No, I mean, it does a little bit, but what concerns me is evil is perpetrated by evil people. And innocent people, whether they are God believers or atheists, are victims. Now, can a Christian person do an evil act? Well, sure they can. Absolutely, no doubt about it. But the question that we wrestle with is this, is that we tend to, in our heart, believe that because we are God's people, that some another we are immune to and or should be protected in a very special way apart from everybody else. I am one who does believe in God's intervention. I want you to know that. I really do. I've preached about this, God's miracles, God's thing. I've talked about that. But I do think that God is less involved in evil and much more involved in blessings. And yet when evil occurs, the question is why didn't God intervene? So let's talk about that, and I'd like to give you a few examples that caught out of the news, one that arrested my attention only because I've done it. Have any of you ever ziplined? Ever done that? God, you know what that is, ziplining? Okay. Ziplining is where you're on vacation, and it's fun, all right? And you're supposed to get the gear on, a little helmet if necessary, and you go clambering up into these trees, and up in the top of the tree is a cable. And these cables are stretched from tree to tree to tree to tree, and you go from station to station to station, and they're rather long. Anyway, you're sort of pushed off, and gravity takes effect, and zip, there you go. And you've got to catch yourself and get yourself up to the next little station, which is below this one, because, you know, you can't go higher. You've got to go lower. When I did this, and Betsy did it, it was really quite enjoyable. We went from station to station to station to station to station, and then it spilled us out into the ocean, right there at the ocean, which was really a very nice treat. And I think I screamed more than Betsy, you know. Now, the reason why I share that with you is a story in the news caught my attention, a lady by the Amy Copeland. Maybe you all remember her. It was in the news recently. She's a 24-year-old lady, looks to be lovely. I don't know anything else other than just having seen her picture. She was apparently on vacation and was doing some zip lining, and something must have happened. She fell, and if I understand it correctly, her leg was cut or something. Some part of her body was injured, and then one thing led to the other, and it was determined that she had a flesh-eating disease that, if it didn't get arrested, was going to kill her. And the last I heard from her, she was released from the hospital, but she had lost, I think, several of her extreme limbs. You know, she actually had to have them amputated to be alive. Now, when I heard that story, here we are. I thought about this lovely lady going through the trees on the zip line, having fun. She's not perpetrating any evil act. I don't know if she's a Christian believer. I don't have any of that information. See, that's not relevant to me. I just want to know why. Well, I do know why. When you are dealing with mechanical things and things that have risk involved them, guess what comes to call? Time and chance and risk. Okay? It just happens. And she happened to be that victim who went plummeting into the forest there, and however this occurred, she is still alive. And just so you'll know, she's very cheerful. She's very, very cheerful in spite of what she has lost and what she has given up. Here this past week in the news over on the coast, I think it was off the Carolina somewhere, was it not? A 6-year-old boy. How old? I didn't say 16. And mean, with his pants hanging off his butt, with earrings and tattoos all over him, and, you know, don't get upset. I'm just, you know, things like that. I'm not sure we can square all that biblically. But this young man was just 6 years old, went wandering out into the ocean and didn't go very far out, and guess what happened? He was bitten by a shark. Just randomly walking out there. Betsy and I were in the beach here about a couple weeks ago, and this was interesting. You know how human beings are. I mean, the ocean is just filled with young people and vacationers and all that. It's gorgeous. The weather was coming in. Well, that night, I had noticed we were out there bobbing around, and I had noticed off to the east there was a guy out there with a pretty good-sized inner tube. Actually, he started out in the water, and he'd get out as far as he could, and he had a casting rod, and he was out there casting this rod. The water was right up to his neck. I mean, it was a calm day, but the water come in, and he was bobbing a little bit, and he was trying to cast out there. He had this little, looked like a little fish on the end there, live bait fishing. Never saw him catch a thing. The next day I saw him out there, he was in an inner tube, one of those little floaty inner tubes that you could get in, and he was laying back in it with his feet propped up, and he was casting. It's the funniest thing. Every time he would cast, he'd flop in. He'd cast, and the boat would go zip, and then all of a sudden he'd start paddling back around to get out there, and he was fishing. Well, I didn't see him catch a thing. However, the next night, Betsy and I were walking along the beach, and there was quite a crowd. And so we went over there, and guess what? It was late in the evening, and he had caught, it looked to be like a shark about this long, right out there in the water where everybody was waiting, or had been waiting. Well, of course, Betsy's family, we had a group of 41 of us together, so you can imagine how many kids were there, all big-eyed, saucer-eyed, looking at this shark, you know, that came out of the water. So the next morning, we couldn't even get him in the ocean. I mean, there's no going in the ocean today. Because seeing that creature, which right now is swimming around out there somewhere, not that one maybe, but many others like it, you know, just the experience, okay, I'm not going to do that. Now, these are just, you could create your own list of terrible things that have happened, and I just want us to talk about it today in light of why it happens and why maybe God doesn't intervene like we think he should. That probably is the relevant question, isn't it? Where is God in the light of all this human suffering? In this book, and I'm assuming this is statistically correct, and I would like to share this with you because it points to an apathy and or an approach toward God which I think is unhealthy in the Western culture. He said that in the previous generations, we Americans were accustomed to suffering. In other words, we got used to seeing things that help us be careful, you know. For example, the way criminals used to be treated and dealt with was a deterrent to violence. You know, you can go up here to Amarillo. I've been there. Actually, it's out of Amarillo, and there's a hotel up there on the way out. So you're going to New Mexico up in there in the little panhandle part. And there's a bar there where they've got some pictures of some people who were criminals. And they've been hung. They were hung. And in one particular scene, I don't mean to be too macabre about this, but the head was not on the body. It was off the body. And now my point is that used to be, we today have been cushioned from that, and we no longer have that deterrent to alert us, hey, don't do that, because if you do these things, this is what's going to happen to you. No, that's missing today. And he talks about that in his book. He goes on to make this point that in the Western civilization then, that we today in our country are basically the only religion that questions suffering. The Hindus don't. The Buddhists don't. The other great religions of the world don't ask the question about where is God. As a matter of fact, they are drawn to God in their suffering. Now think about that for just a moment. In their sufferings, you go to Africa, you go to the impoverished parts of the world, and those people who don't even have the understanding of the one true God that we do, where do they go? They go to God, their understanding of God. They're drawn to God in prayer, and they ask for deliverance. They never blame him. They never ask, where are you, and why didn't this happen? We do in this country, in America. And, of course, guess where most of the atheists live? We got lots of them in this country that we enjoy. I thought this was an interesting quote. It says, there's a little something off-key about Western academics saying, I have lost my faith because of the suffering of the Rwandans. While Rwandans are saying, quote, our faith draws us closer to the only one who can console and protect us, which is God. Isn't that interesting to you? It is to me. And it makes me think a little bit about things. Boy, I'm truly blessed. I just tell you I am, and I appreciate that. Betsy and I, like this morning, we were sitting having a bite of breakfast, had some mighty good eggs, and we were looking out the window, and right outside our breakfast window, we have a big container of sugar water where I go out and drink every morning. No, it's for the hummingbirds. And we sit there every morning when we have breakfast, and we watch this circus of energy and flying and anger. It looks like all the little things that go on there. And we've got wasps involved. We've got lizards involved. I mean, it's just we just sit there and we talk about it. And I was just thinking about this creation that God made, how complete it was. And it takes us back then to consider some things I'd like you to just think your way through with me. And again, if you'd like to talk about it, I think it's a good conversation on the Sabbath, because I'd like for us to think back to Genesis 1 and 2, and then I want us to consider Genesis 3. There's a lot of debate in the church. People get very anchored to philosophies and thoughts about the creation and the length of it and so forth and so on. And although I understand that to some degree, it frustrates me, because is not the issue this? Either God did create or he did not. He either exists or he doesn't. How he created what you and I enjoy, it's beyond me. It's beyond me. I would love to have been there when how he did it. I mean, when that moment came in the history of all of time, and all of a sudden God said, let there be, and boom. And however he did that, I can't do it, but I believe in Genesis 1:1, don't you? I mean, come on now, get your minds around this a little bit. How do you create something from non-existent material? Yeah, that's the word bara, create. God created. I mean, come on, how do you make something from non-existence? I can't do it, can you? But God can do it, and he did it. And what I want you to think about is, this is the way I want you to phrase this, the way things were meant to be, the way things are. I don't want to necessarily spend a lot of time talking to you about the way things were meant to be. I'd like to talk to you about the way things are, because I live with the way things are. Walk with me through this just a moment. Let's go back through the 6 days of creation for a moment. 6 days, God made all the animals. He made those hummingbirds, made those rotten little wasps. I hate those red wasps. He made those little lizards that get up there, and all of a sudden, this, I guess it's mating season or something, gets up there, and this little red thing comes out from underneath his jaw, gets up there. He's got these little suction cups. He jumps onto the window. I mean, I'm just amazed. And then he jumps off this little container of sugar. God made all of that. But here's my question. I was thinking about this. Was there pain the way it was meant to be? Okay, you go to Genesis 1 and 2 in the world. Was there pain? Now, I'm differentiating here between pain and suffering. The reason why I say this is, if Adam and Eve are walking along in the Garden of Eden, and they got to walking along hurriedly because they were excited about something, and Adam turned his ankle, do you think there was any pain? I do. I think there was pain. I think that if they inadvertently went to get a beautiful rose, you know, people like to debate whether there were thorns on roses. So I'll just give you this. Let's just say there were no thorns on the roses. But have you ever done this? Reach for something and those little blades, those little rose blades are so sharp that you reach in there and guess what happens? You get cut, don't you? You get cut. Well, what I'm asking you here is, do you think there was any pain in that? I suggest to you there was. Now, let's just talk about other things, you know, because we've got the PETA movement and all these kinds of things that we have to worry about in our world today. But here Adam and Eve are walking away in the Garden of Eden, doing their business, you know, talking. Isn't this interesting? In conversation with God. Isn't that something? The way things were meant to be. They were in conversation with God. I propose to you, if you read Genesis 1 and 2, that you are actually looking at the way things were meant to be. It's also where the book of Revelation is taking us. If you look at Revelation, the closing chapters there, we are going back to be the way it was meant to be. They're walking through the Garden of Eden, and can we say fire ants in the Garden of Eden just for the sake of the illustration? Do you think? I hate fire ants. I don't know what good a fire ant serves, but that's neither here nor there. So, and I'm not going to let the fire ant bite Adam, but Adam's just walking along, and his number 7, we're going to make perfect shoe fit. You know, got to have a perfect foot. So he's got a perfect 7 size, and he steps on, inadvertently, didn't do it on purpose, but steps on a cricket. That's a good idea around here. We got a lot of crickets in our office. Boy, did that animal lose its life? Do you think? No, everybody's heard that. Well, everything. There was no death. I'm just in my. If God created a humpback whale, which He did He not? Prior to the creation of man, that humpback whale is swimming around off the coasts of Alaska. A huge animal. It eats 5,000 pounds of fish twice a day. That's a lot of fish. Eats herring, eats mackerel, 5,000 pounds. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up, prior to the creation of man, right, then when those creatures were made, were other fish being eaten by other fish? Do you think? What do you think? Of course, kind of a thing. So the idea, okay, what about the? You hear this big humpback whale goes up there and it's got all this going up there and gobbles up 4,999 pounds of fish, but one pounder got away, and yet he's wounded, and he's flopping around there, kind of a thing. Do you think that fish is experiencing any kind of pain? Now, I don't know what animals are, so I got to be careful here. I'm not sure to what degree animals experience pain like we do. But, boy, my little dog used to cry out, kind of a thing. So, but I think it's a different kind of pain than we human beings experience. All right, so you just follow me. The way things were meant to be, permit me this, the universe was designed in a certain way with a certain purpose. Would you grant me that? Okay. And God intended things to be a certain way, but then something happened. What happened? Genesis 3 happened. That's called famously the fall, man's fall, Adam and Eve, and the story there. And I'd like to just, you know the story, so I'm not going to turn there today. I want you to just follow along with me with the creation of all the animal kind. I'm going to interrupt myself here because one of the most atrocious things in nature, which just it just pulls at my heartstrings every time I see it, is to read about these little sea turtles. You know, were there sea turtles prior to they were created prior to man, were they not? Okay. Were frigate birds created prior to man? Yes, they were. Were seagulls created prior to man? Yes, they were. Well, guess what frigate birds and seagulls munch on once they're hatched? Have you seen those stories? I was watching a Jacques Cousteau program the other day until it got a little bit too questionable for me, and then I turned it off. But there was a part of it that showed this big old sea turtle, you know, lumbering up out of the ocean, waddling up there, finding the warm sand, laying anywhere from 50 to 250 eggs in there, and then she leaves them. Okay, and then X amount of days later, I don't know how long, many days it was later. Guess what? Hatches. These little guys come out of there, and they poke their heads up. And if it's in the daylight, guess what? Immediately shows up. Frigate birds or gulls, and guess what they do to these little creatures who are trying to do what? Trying to get out of that hole and trying to get to the ocean. Little feet just paddle along, that kind of thing, and they show all these little birds, and all of a sudden here comes, whoosh, grabs him and He's up there munching. You hear him crunching on him, kind of thing. And I thought, whew, I hate that. I hate that. But my suggestion to you is that that's a reaction we have because we're compassionate and tenderhearted. But this is the way it is it not? That is the way God created it. And that was the expression of God's plan so that this earth could accommodate we human beings in the miraculous way that it does. It takes all of this for us to be here today. He makes the point, and I agree with this in this book. Do you think that there were earthquakes on the earth before? There are 1,000 people on earth. In other words, when Adam and Eve were created, do you think here in America, because they weren't created here in America, but do you think that there were forest fires in the Rocky Mountains? Well, sure there were. Because there's storms, there's lightning. I mean, God created all that. Lightning comes out of nowhere, and it strikes a dry tree, and boom, you've got a flame. Now, God set it up that way, but we then, guess what we human beings do, who are uniquely made apart from the sea turtles and the humpback whales, because God has given us lots of things, one of which is reason. You know, I sit in my home occasionally, and I look out, and I have made a decision. I live in Tyler, Texas, which is in Tornado Alley. Okay? Now, was this Tornado Alley 4,000 years ago? As far as I know, it was. But who made the choice? God didn't make it. I made the choice to build my house in Tyler, Texas. And check this out. I like trees, and so I built my house with a bunch of trees really all around me. So guess what happens if there's a forest fire? Is my house likely to be burned down? Whose call was this? Who built the house in the trees in Tyler, Texas? I did. God had nothing to do with that. So if a forest fire came rumbling through my neck of the woods, do I have the right to inquire of God, where were you? Why did you let this happen to me? God's sitting up there. I'm humanizing him. What? You're the one who knew that this was Tornado Alley. Now get this. When I built my house, I told Betsy, I said, I'm going to do something. I said, I'm going to build a storm cellar in my house to escape the tornadoes. Well, my builder talked me out of it, and I don't have a storm cellar. You know what I wish I had now? A storm cellar. Because I know something. A tornado has no conscience. This is still Tornado Alley, and I'm just making these points to recognize that when I look at what happened, God, there were earthquakes, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. There were. There were raging forest fires. You can go back and read histories of what happened in the West long before mankind settled it. There were raging grass fires in the Middle Plains states. Was there disease? Yes, there was disease. It was rampant. You know, whether it came from people who brought it over from Europe or whether it came from the South, wherever it came from, they didn't have the shots to inoculate people back then, and there were people dying by the tens of thousands, okay? And if you go back and check at least some of the things that killed some of the Western Indians, and I've been studying that lately, and that's because with mankind came something they were not used to, and that is human waste. And the Western settlers oftentimes would get cholera and other diseases because they were drinking water which had stuff in it that shouldn't be in there. Well, whose fault was that? See? In other words, when it's not, let's be careful about dragging God into things that are who did it? We did it. We did it because we have free moral choice. When I look at what happened in Genesis, the story there in Genesis 2 and 3, I'd like to propose this idea to you. The tree of knowledge of good and evil. Let's talk about what God asked them, the only thing he asked them not to do. The only thing. What was it? He said, he made a prohibition. Don't eat of the tree. No, that one's off limits to you. Have everything else. In other words, if you want... This is my prescription for happiness and long life. Everything else is yours, but don't eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. All right? Even the fact that he gave them choice tells you immediately what was different about this magnificent creation that he made from the animals. The difference is he gave them reason and choice. Those humpback whales, those fire ants, they don't really have any choice. They're all creatures of instinct. And I was just, I've often laughed about this a little bit, you know, when you get on a boat like I've done before and you get out there and everybody's out whale watching and they want to go out and they want to go find some whales. And somebody said, there's a whale. And everybody runs from this side of the boat. They all go on that side of the boat and they look at that whale. Sometimes you'll have a mama whale. I don't know what you call it. It's got a baby, but it's a mama whale. It's a what?
It's a cow.
It's a cow. There's a cow out there. Moo. No. No, it is a cow. You're exactly right. It is a cow. She has a calf. That's exactly right. But here's my point is we get over there and we talk and we say, isn't that cute? Isn't that sweet? You know, and they'll throw their flute up on you, that kind of thing. When's the last time you've seen a whale turn around and come up and talk to the people on the boat? In other words, there is a pretty big difference between this creature that God made on the sixth day and the ones he made all the other days. And the one he made on the sixth day, he only gave him one prohibition. He said, don't do this. And he basically, if I may put it into language which makes sense to me, he said this. He says, I have a plan for you, and this is the way this will happen. If you want life and happiness, do not eat of that tree. All right, we know what happens in Genesis 3. Temptation came along. And what did they do? They basically decided, the two of them together, they opted then to know good and evil. Notice this. They, by choosing that tree, opted to know good and evil and gave way rather than yielding to God's way. He made the wrong choice. Then, man made the wrong choice. He did not listen to God. He chose to leave God's plan and to have to decide for himself what is right and wrong. What immediately happened? He's removed from God's presence. Now, when you distance yourself from God, what's going on here? When you distance yourself from God, you are losing a spiritual connection. All right. Now, God was still speaking to them in a uniquely different way than he is to us today. But my point is this, is God said, you got to get out of the garden. And all of a sudden, things were dramatically different, were they not? Betsy and I, we were chatting about it this morning. It's sort of like this. I don't know, I wasn't there, but in the Garden of Eden, it was sort of like the difference between the way things were meant to be versus the way where things were made is this. There, they got to go to the grocery store. Then, they had to go out and till the ground and get with the bugs and labor and work and so forth to get the produce. You sort of follow my thinking there? I don't know how it was, but whatever was there, they were pretty well taken care of in the garden. Then all of a sudden, they chose to know good and evil, and God says, you got to get out. You have not chosen my plan for you. You have chosen your plan. With that plan comes consequences. What was one of the most immediate consequences? They had children, and what immediately happened? Did Eve suffer? You know, it talks about in childbirth. Now, let me just talk about that. We could talk about the pain issue quite a bit, but pain, I think, existed before. But the kind of pain we're talking about there is the kind of pain where a mother suffers over her child with the anguish of wondering what in the world is ahead for this child. And what was ahead for Cain? Murder. Now, you mothers in this room, I want you to think about this. I want you to think about your son being a murderer and a polygamist. Boy, we're really getting away from God, aren't we? From the original plan? Because that was not part of the Garden of Eden experience. That was not meant to be. That was not happiness and long life, but they chose a different way. And when you step away from the presence of God, and I would like to offer this as a realistic reality, we have come a long way. We in America have come a long way from God, and we can't seem to make a right choice, period. We can't even figure out that abortion violates God's laws. We choose, women by the hundreds of thousands of women and husbands choose to abort a child. Do they not? Boy, that's going to be a toughie to square. You know, don't you think? I mean, that's that child. I mean, I know the abortion argument. I'm just trying to say, my. I don't know when that even became an option, but it is an option today. There's so many things in our society today we cannot figure out. We've been so far removed from God. We're just distancing ourselves. And why? Because we're disobedient to His commandments and His laws and His teachings. So they were cast out. I would like you to be mindful of this. They didn't fall because they figured out the meaning of evil. They fell because they did evil. By that I mean they transgressed God's will and way. The consequence of that was death. Now just think about this for a moment. And I don't know how things were meant to be, for sure, because I only get two chapters. Now we could talk about Isaiah 11, Isaiah 35. I've got all that, but I'm talking about Genesis 1 and 2, maybe Revelation 21 and 22, because that's the way things are going to become again, the tree of life and so forth that's mentioned there. But one of the things that interests me is this matter, the consequence is then God says, the day that you eat of this, you will die. Now, we know they did not die then, but they became aware of death. You know, one of the things that most people worry about more than anything else, especially as you get older, is what? Death. They became aware of death. The way things were, I don't have the answer to this. I just know this, that I'm a dog person. I had three Shelties. And with each one of them, I don't think any of those dogs knew that they were going to die. Do you think that they did? I think they had no awareness that, I mean, the next morning, Smokes was not going to, that would be his last breath. I don't think he thought that. But when man sinned, guess what he became aware of? He became acutely aware that he is going to die. And that is carried with us today, and it affects us. There's a sort of a fancy word that you hear tossed about. I've studied it a little bit as a result of this book, and this is the difficulty we get into. It's called theodicy. Theodicy is this: God is good, correct? Yes, He is. He's good. He's benevolent. God is good. Okay? But how then is there so much evil? If God is good and He loves His creation, how come there is so much evil in the world? And this understanding of it, how it works, how can God be one way with this happening, is called a study of theodicy. I would like for you, if you will, to take your book, Bible, that's what I call the book, and I would like for us to turn to the greatest example of suffering other than Jesus Christ in the Bible, which I'm aware of, is the example of who? Job. And I just want us to read a couple of things about Job, because this is a study in God's educating Job about His plan and His purpose. While you're turning there, I would like to give you a quote from a philosopher that I have been fond of for a good number of years. Like most philosophers, I don't agree with everything he said, but I do like this. His name is Epicurus, and he was a Greek philosopher. He liked to identify himself with happiness and long life, and that's the reason why that appeals to me. He stated the problem of evil this way. He said this. Listen carefully now, because you can get lost in this maze of words here. God either wishes to take away evils and is unable, or He is able and unwilling, or He is neither willing nor able, or He is willing and able. Now for an explanation. His. If He is willing and unable, He's feeble, which does not agree with the character of God. If He is able and unwilling, He is malicious, which is equally at odds with God. If He is neither willing nor able, He is both malicious and feeble, and therefore not God. Finally, if He is both willing and able, which is alone suitable to God, from what source then comes evils, and why does He not remove them? This is at the heart of the argument of theodicy, God's goodness, and the evils that are in this world. Here in the book of Job, again, I know most of you are familiar with this, but boy, what a startling example involving a very righteous man. And when I review this with you, I think that we can begin. I mean, I know that Job was at fault, but God wanted him to learn a lesson, did he not? He wanted him to understand something. And I think sometimes we forget that lesson as well. In Job, I think it's chapter 38. If you'll turn there with me, read just a couple of these texts. Job chapter 38. Now, God made all that there is, and I'm going to ask you a question. And I don't want to mean, I have no intention of confusing you, but I want to add some clarity. Is God omnipotent? Yeah, he is. Don't be worried. That's a good question. Yes, he is omnipotent. Now, what does it mean to be omnipotent? And this is where I think sometimes we err, because we expect God to do things that he, listen carefully, cannot do. He cannot do. Omnipotence does not mean the ability to do anything. It means you possess the unlimited power to do what needs to be done. So that means God has unlimited power to do what he wants to do. Does he? Can God tell a lie? No. Well, wait a minute, I thought he was omnipotent. If he's omnipotent, then he should be able to tell a lie, correct? Well, he is omnipotent, but he doesn't have the power to do that. You follow me? That's not God. That he is not put together to tell a lie. All right? He can't do it. Can God make a four-sided triangle? Can he make a four-sided triangle? No, he can't. Wait a minute, I thought you just agreed with me that God is omnipotent. Well, of course, this is somewhat trivial. Those are just things that he cannot do. That's impossible, because by definition, a triangle only has three sides, correct? Here's my concern. I want you to think with me as we go through this a little bit. Why then do we call upon God or expect of him things that he cannot do? Good question, isn't it? Things that he cannot do. And why can he not do them? Because when he created this remarkable universe with the fullest desire to have the expression of mankind as the culmination of his creation, he made this earth to have fires, tsunamis, earthquakes. And if you'll study this, you'll find out, interestingly enough, that these types of things are vital to sustain life on earth. But just to interrupt my thinking here with you, where do we human beings build, most of us live? Where do most human beings live? I already told you, Mark is right. If you take a look at just at night, you know, show these pictures of the United States of America at nighttime, you know, from up in space. Look all along the coast. Just look all along the coast, okay? And over here in California, everybody knows about the San Andreas Fault, right? The San Andreas Fault was there before it was ever discovered. And guess what they were having? Earthquakes. The earth was being readjusted. Man moves in and builds where? Builds where there are earthquakes. You go over to Japan, and I've lived in Japan, so I'm a little bit of a, I have knowledge of that. You know, the nuclear reactor, guess where the nuclear reactor was? Right on the coast. And when I was there, we had all sorts of horrendous storms that would come into Japan. And they've been coming for years and years and years and years and years and years. Man comes along and he builds where? Right where the tsunamis and these terrible storms come. And then when they happen, everybody says, well, where was God? Well, God made all that. We're given a you-know-what to sort of figure this out, aren't we? I was thinking about the terrible tragedy in Katrina down there in New Orleans, a terrible tragedy. Okay, have any of you ever been to New Orleans? I've been there many times. You drive there and you drop below sea level. And you get into New Orleans, and guess what? It's been below sea level as long as I know. You know, it's basically a Mississippi Delta area, and that mud that comes out of the north goes all the way down the Mississippi, flushes out into the Gulf, and it built this peninsula, and you got New Orleans, you got all that there, and that's been there a long, long, long time. Man moves in and guess where he builds. And so this terrible storm, and by the way, these storms have been coming through for thousands of years, all over the Gulf, sometimes in Alabama, sometimes up in Florida, sometimes in Texas. They've been coming through year after year after year, and they come through, and finally it goes through the worst possible scenario because man has built homes below sea level, and that hurricane came through there and spilled the water out in a perfect storm, and thousands of people were tragically affected. And I regret the loss of life, but I cannot blame God for what he didn't do. But I can point the finger at who? Me. For building in that environment. Of course, what do we do? We're rebuilding. What are we doing? We're rebuilding, which is if it was susceptible then, it's just as susceptible now, correct? And yet when it happens, people are going to say, why didn't God stop that? My question to you is why did you build there? Because it appears to me that all of this, God created all this for the benefit, so he would have the fullest expression of you and me because we have free will and we are supposed to make decisions. This matter of omnipotence, I want to be very clear about it then, is that God is omnipotent, but he does not have the ability to do the impossible or that which is stupid. He just does, or nonsensical. There's a conundrum. I don't know if I'll waste your time with this, but if you want to look into it, it's sort of fascinating. You know, this is one of the questions philosophers get into. Can God, who is omnipotent, are you ready for this? This is debatable. Can God build a stone too heavy for him to lift? He's omnipotent, isn't he? Can God build a stone too heavy for him to lift? That's called the stone paradox. Well, that's sort of nonsensical, isn't it? The answer is God is omnipotent, and that's a foolish question. That is, he remains omnipotent, ladies and gentlemen, but that is a foolish question. It is of no interest other than debate. Now, here in Job chapter, get over here, Job chapter, a couple verses I want us to think about. Job 38, yes. This is this dialogue between our God and Job. And sometimes we put ourselves in Job's position. We'll say, well, God, he was a righteous man, and he asked the question, sort of, why did this happen to me? The title of this sermon was God's View, God's Eye View. You know what I mean by God's Eye View? It's sort of like a parent's view for their children. When my daughters, I have two daughters, and when they were younger, notice the words here, when they were younger and didn't know for themselves, I decided, I won't tell you which one, because she threw a hissy fit. You know what a hissy fit is. And I had never really seen a hissy fit out of her, but I saw one on this day. I decided, because I have dad's eye view, and I could look at her teeth, and I could see that her teeth were crooked. I knew that she was going to get into high school eventually, so Dad decided to do something for her that was going to hurt. You know, because if you have braces, these teeth move around, and it's uncomfortable. And I don't really know how they do it, because it's been many, 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 many years since I had braces, and I was terrible about it. I took mine out. Back in the day when I had braces, they were little plastic things, not these little wire things, but you just put it in your mouth. I just threw it away. And so, you know, that's why I have some crooked teeth today. So, but back to my point. Dad's eye view. Daughter needed straight teeth. Does daughter want to go to the dentist? What's the answer? No. Why? It hurts. It's not going to be any fun. So Dad says, well, trust Dad on this. So we go to the orthodontist, and sure enough, we do that, and she has all these little wires and all these things. She comes out of there, and she throws a hissy fit. Okay? which surprised me. And I just had to tell her to suck it up. You know, be tough, like her dad would be. Okay? We use every trick, every ploy. Now, here's the point, is that did I do the right thing for her? Sure I did. Did it hurt her a little bit? Yes, it did. Why would I have subjected to her to that hurt, or what I would call suffering? Why would I do that? Because I know that it is for her own good. All right. So we have this element then of God and God's eye view of doing things for us that's for our own view. And I suggest to you in Job, if you read this whole experience here, what God is talking to Job about is to educate him on who's got the view. Job doesn't have the view. He's terrible. He's covered with sores and he's in a rotten position, you know. But yet he still hasn't given up on his faith on God. But what's happening here is different when seen from whose viewpoint? God's viewpoint versus Job's. Notice here, he begins to upbraid him a little bit in verse 4 of chapter 38, and he says this. He says, Job, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me. You know, you're questioning who I am in my existence. You tell me, where were you when I made the earth? When all of a sudden, boom, however it happened. And I set in motion the laws of the universe that if you read this little book, and I'm sure, I know John, he may preach out of this too, there's such a thing today is called the anthropomorphic principle, which is simply this, is that in the creation, in that moment that it happened, mathematically, the world, the universe, was perfect. And it was built perfect through God's mathematical genius, I'll put it in that particular way, to support something. What do you think that was? Man. The black inkiness of space, the distance of the planets, the rotation of everything that's all around us, and our distance from the sun, all these, boom! God did that. I don't know how he did it, but it's rather amazing how he did it. So he's talking to Job, who's sitting there in misery and suffering. He says, where were you when I did that? You question who I am and what I can do? Well, listen. He goes on to talk about a number of things here. Who laid the measures thereof, if you know, or who has stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundation thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof? And, of course, the answer is Job didn't have a clue. He didn't have a clue. Now, the reason why I want to sort of step away from this just a moment, and there's so much more, and I'll just encourage you if you would like to read the book, or maybe John will preach about it again sometime, or I might, is, you know, try to look at things, suffering and pain, from God's view. It's not God's intention for a man to suffer. I don't see it. So the reason I suffer today is why? Because Adam and Eve made a choice and sin entered into the world. And with free choice, lots of bad things happen. If you marry someone and you have the unfortunate experience of having a child that is born limbless, okay, that's a horrendous thing. Although people tell about how they survive, but that happens to you. Whose fault is that? It isn't what God didn't do. It's really not anybody's fault. It's just the way genetics worked and the consequences and the multiple variables at work in a world that works with, and I told you we're resistant to this, to time and chance. Time and chance is at play every moment of our lives. You know? Therein then we have the responsibility to be in a relationship with God which is totally unique, available to none other of his creation but only us. As I try to wrap it up here in the next few minutes, I want to address one other question which I have thought about myself over a lot of time, and that is this. It is called God's disappearance. God's disappearance. What this relates to is the fact that when you look in the garden, the way things were meant to be, God was in communication with his creation, Adam and Eve. All right? Genesis 3, things became the way they are now, not meant to be, but had to be because God created it that way once you exercise free moral agency. So guess who is you're seeing less and less of in the Scripture? Because man is becoming more violent, sinful, disobedient, moving away from Him. So guess who you see less and less of in the Scripture? You see less and less of God. You don't see Him in person. In fact, when you get back to the prophets, who do you see? You see the prophets, and sometimes the prophets aren't even hearing from God directly. Correct? Come to the New Testament. Let's come to the New Testament. You don't see God at all except through the personage and the life and the testimony of His Son. Do you? And where is God today? Is He hidden from us? Is He hidden from us? I think that this is an interesting little thing I want you to notice here. Just one other place. Save your place in Job, because I'm probably going to close there in just a few minutes. But this we must see. Deuteronomy 31 and verse 17. A verse that has a lot of relevance to us as God's people trying to live His way. Deuteronomy 31 and verse 17 says this. Then my anger shall be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will what? I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, are not these evils come upon us, because our God is not among us. So what did God, what's the language that He used? He says, I will hide my face from them. I will quote to you a few psalms. Here's what they say. Psalm 44:23 says, awake, the psalmist writes, why do you sleep, O Lord? Arise, cast us not off forever. Why do you hide your face and forget our affliction and our oppression? For our soul is bowed down to the dust. Our bellies cleave to the earth. Arise for our help and redeem us for your mercy's sake. Psalm 88:13 says this, but unto you have I cried, O Lord, and in the morning shall my prayer prevent you. Lord, why cast you off my soul? Why hide you your face from me? I am afflicted and ready to die, psalmist wrote. Psalm 10:1 says, why stand you afar off, O Lord? Why hide you yourself in time of troubles? Do you sort of see a connection here? We get farther and farther and farther away. And by the way, as Christians in God's church, let's be very blunt about this. What separates you from God? What creates the distance? Sin does. Iniquity and evil. When you choose to do your way rather than God's way, you in a way experience what happened in Genesis 1 and 2 and 3. You're removed. Because God does not dwell in the presence of evil. He distances Himself from that. The hiddenness of God. Well, I haven't seen Him. But I thought that this was a pretty interesting statement. You boil it all down. Where is God today? God today has become invisible in this world so that His presence would be obvious only to those who seek Him. I thought that was pretty interesting. Because though I have not seen God, I have seen God. Follow me? I mean, not literally, but I see God in the Bible. I see God in you. I see God in a little child. I see God in that hummingbird. When I collapse on my knees in prayer, what am I doing? I'm acknowledging the fact that I know what Job knows. And what did Job know? Job knew that his Creator lived and existed. Turn back there to Job 42, and this is a conclusion that we can come to. As we consider then the violent age and times in which we live and the existence of evil and suffering and who is to blame and where is God, because I know that God does exist. God is not asleep. God is not hidden, because I know that He exists, and so do you. Here it says over in verse 1, 42 of Job, then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything. Well, He can do everything except the impossible. You follow me? And let's not ask God to do the impossible. And that no thought can be withheld from you. Who is he that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. And I am left with this awareness that in the creation of the world and all that God made, however he did it, it's too wonderful for me. It's beyond my grasp, and I cannot get it. I just have to stand in utter amazement and awe and fascination of a God who loves me as much as he did and gave me all of this, all that is around me, as a benefit to being one that he gave the gift of reasoning and free will to obey him. It is my thought that God allows natural suffering in the form of earthquakes and disease, some forms of evil, he allows it because they are part of the formula that came about in the creation of the universe. There were earthquakes. You build on an earthquake fault, you're going to pay for it. From the creation of the earth, he has made me a conscious, intelligent, and free human being to make choices. And this, there is some consolation here, so listen carefully. The moral evil that's perpetrated by this human creation, horrendous things, it is the direct outcome of God having made me and everyone else a free person with the capacity to do moral evil or do moral good. Certainly, the moral evil is avoidable, but it is only avoidable by the humans who are doing it. Follow me? By the humans who are doing it. So as we close today on a beautiful Sabbath day, brethren who may meet in safety, and we have been truly blessed, I'd like us to think just a little bit more about this hiddenness of God. And we are not going to perpetrate moral evil, so let's not do that. Let's keep the Ten Commandments. Let's draw closer to God. Let's not go farther away from God. Moral evil isn't, that's not us. We wouldn't dare do that. But I got to thinking about the relationship that they had, that Adam and Eve had with God, and even Moses and Noah and all the great patriarchs, and sometimes you can almost be envious of that. But because of the diversity of this world in which we live and the things that have come upon us, I am left with the reality that, yes, I do know he exists, and I do have an opportunity to do something which establishes a relationship that very, very, very few people really have, and is represented in the initial statement of Jesus Christ when he gave that model Lord's Prayer. Because you believe, and because I believe, because we believe, God is not hidden from us. And we will not implicate him in our moral sickness and moral evil, because we know better. We will beg his intervention. We will pray for his blessings and his comfort. We will seek his will. We will seek his courage. We will seek to be uplifted, but we will never place blame. We will not fall on our knees and question the great God of all the universe for what we ourselves have brought upon ourselves through our ignorance and our disobedience and our unfaithfulness, because we're getting what we deserve. We are getting what we deserve. But something magical, not magical, something, I don't know, you call it what you want to. When you and I get on our knees and we pray, what does it say to our God, the God of all this universe, who created all that there is, and by him, Hebrews 11 says, by him, by faith do we know that God created the world. Hebrews 11, I think, verse 3. By faith we know that he did that. So by faith I get on my knees and I say these very interesting words to the God of all that is and will be, who is beyond my grasp, who made all of this. We say, my Father, which art in heaven, Hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, and thy will be done.